Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2018, and you're listening to episode 67 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by our resident film reviewer, Dr. John McAteer. John is an assistant professor and chair of the online liberal arts program at Ashford University. He has a BA in film from Biola University, a MA in Philosophy of Religion and Ethics from Talbot School of Theology, and a PhD in Philosophy from the University of California at Riverside. John has written a film review about the new Steven Spielberg-directed film, Ready Player One, and his review is called Spielberg's Nostalgia for Reality in Ready Player One, which is available free online at our website, equip.org. John, it's good to have you on.
I'm glad to be here. I'm excited about this.
Well, first of all, I want to tell our listeners that this will be a spoiler-filled conversation. So if you like to see a film first and avoid spoilers, then I'd say come back to this after you've done so. But this film, Ready Player One, is based on the book that was published in 2011 by Ernest Cline, and that book has been translated into 20 languages, so it's quite popular. So describe for us what the movie is about.
Yeah, the movie and the original novel are fairly similar. They are they made some changes in the movie to kind of streamline it and make it more action oriented. But when the novel came out, the basic premise was described as the Matrix meets Willy Wonka, which I think is actually perfect. So if you think about the Matrix, is this world of virtual reality where you can go in and everything looks sort of real, but it's not. And in Ready Player One, that's the way the whole world is. Everything is kind of bad and dystopian in real life society. So people have gone into this virtual reality world called the Oasis, which they can sort of live out their fantasy lives in and create however they want and create whatever they imagine. So very similar to the Matrix, only people voluntarily choose to live there. And then the story follows the creator of the Oasis, James Halliday, has died, and he creates a contest to see who is going to inherit control of the Oasis. And he creates a series of sort of video game-like puzzles that people have to solve, and whoever can solve it first inherits his fortune. So again, it's very similar to Willy Wonka, where you have these children that go through these series of tests to see who is going to inherit the chocolate factory. So that's the story.
Well, this film, as you mentioned, and the book talks about this virtual world, kind of the Oasis. It's kind of like a giant video game, but it's part of the daily life for all these users in this, you know, dystopian world in the future. And it's like a worldwide thing. And of course, today we have our own virtual, you know, realms where people hang out every day, like Facebook and other, you know, social media platforms. So do you think our culture currently depends upon just kind of virtual reality or virtual community? And how do you think it affects Christians to be overly dependent upon technology?
Yeah, that's a great question, a great comparison, I think, because really the movie, you know, it talks about virtual reality in the novel. But I think that's too narrow of a way of thinking about the concerns, that the authors are getting at here. It's not just about, video games and, or even just, you know, virtual reality per se, but it's about, I think it's about the internet in general. So if you think about, you know, what the future of the internet is going to look like. You know, I think the novelist Ernest Cline was kind of imagining like someday the internet will just be virtual reality all the time. And that may or may not ever come to pass. But certainly today we are engaged in things that are virtual in the sense that they're not real. You know, Amazon is not a real store. It's a virtual store. It's a store that you go to online and buy things, right? Facebook is a virtual space for talking to friends. And So what Ernest Cline imagined was a world in the future where Facebook, Amazon, Google, all of that stuff is one giant company. And they kind of obscure this in the film a little bit, but he's thinking about this as controlling all of your life, kind of the way that the internet is starting to control all of our lives. You know, people go to school in the Oasis. There are no schools in real life. All the schools are online, right? And we can imagine that could happen in real life in 20 years when the movie is set by 2045 or whatever it is. I can imagine most schools being digital online. Already we're seeing most shopping and things transition. Media, internet, films and TV shows are all shifting online. So this is a trajectory that we're already on. And it does raise some questions, as you say, ethical questions about how we ought to engage with this stuff. And I think I'm sure we'll talk about this more as the conversation goes on. But one of the questions the movie is asking is, how can we engage ethically? And what is media for in general? What is the internet for? How can we use it in a way that's healthy and not harmful to ourselves as human beings and living our lives?
Well, Ready Player One is showing this dystopian future after some like online internet wars and all kinds of things like that. And do you see any parts of the book as true now or becoming true? One thing I think that I can't remember if it was in the book because I did read the book, but it did show in the film like all these drones delivering packages, which is pretty much happening now. They're testing that happening currently. In fact, my oldest son goes to college and their local, one of the local fast food restaurants had selected the resident house where he lives in as a place where they could do drone delivery. And so some people tried it out and had the drones deliver them a meal.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't even have to leave your house to go and get food now. So it's just delivered directly by robots, basically by computers. So this is certainly a path that we're on. I think in terms of the dystopianness of the future, one of the things that the author of the book maybe is not quite as interested in as Spielberg. Spielberg emphasizes how dark this world is. The world outside of the computers we see is kind of run down. Everybody is engaged in the Oasis as much as they can. You know, you just see people everywhere in the background of the real life scenes. Everybody's wearing these virtual reality goggles and never engaging with the people who are standing or sitting right next to them. The opening scene of the movie goes through the stacks, they call them. It's basically a vertical trailer park where the main character lives, and they show all the people living in these different things. It's very crowded. Everybody's right next to each other, but they're not engaging with each other in any way. We see people using it as an escape, almost as a drug. There's one character who looks and acts like a drug addict, but he's addicted to this virtual world and doesn't want to live his real life. He's just numbing his pain. And I think I found that opening scene fairly convicting personally. There's one scene where you see a mother at the breakfast table with her children, and she's wearing the virtual reality goggles instead of talking to her kids who are supposed to be eating breakfast. And you see people at work in meetings where they're supposed to be talking to their coworkers and they're wearing the goggles and doing something else. And so that convicted me of a lot of times not being present to the things, to my children or to my work or whatever ways that I'm distracted by my phone. Right. So I don't think it's just making a statement about virtual reality per se, but the ways in which we engage with technology and it disconnects us from what's around us.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the motivation of the character James Halliday, because he was, as you mentioned, the Oasis creator, or co-creator rather. He also created it with his friend Ogden Morrow, who at the time of this contest that you mentioned is still alive, although James Halliday has deceased. And why do you think he decides to give all his money away in the contest. In other words, the point of this contest is if you win and find what's called the Easter egg, and maybe you can explain that. That's a very nerd term, the Easter egg. Then you will get control of the entire Oasis. Like, you're going to have control of the entire internet. So why do you think he did that, and why he wouldn't, for example, leave all of his money to charity?
Yeah, so an Easter egg in video game terminology is just something that the creator of the game puts in that's not really part of the game per se. You don't need to find it to play the game or to win the game, but it's there just sort of for fun, something personal that the creator of the game put in to be like an inside joke or something like that. And nowadays the word Easter egg gets stretched to include, you know, references in movies and things, if just anything that's a reference to something else that is not directly part of the story, but just kind of a fun little thing, that an inside joke between the viewers and the creator. And in terms of Halliday's motivations, it's an interesting question. Why wouldn't he have given the money to charity or to his co-founder Ogden Morrow? They don't really develop the personality or the relationship too much between Morrow and Halliday in the film. I think in the book it's implied Morrow has left the company years before. I guess that's in the film as well, but they've had a falling out, so that's why they're not personally friends anymore. He wouldn't give the money to Morrow. And you ask about a charity. I think if you're thinking of the contest as primarily about money, then that makes sense. You could give your fortune to a charity if you had no family surviving. But really what's at stake is not money, but it's control of the company. So the winner inherits the Oasis itself and gets to decide the future of what this invention is going to be about. So I'm not sure how you could donate the Oasis to charity. You know, that'd be like saying we're going to donate the internet to charity, right? That doesn't make sense. So really, it's a metaphor for you know, who gets to decide what the future of the internet is going to be, what kind of place this is, and how we get to interact with each other there. And the bad guys in the story are corporate people, a business who wants to take over this Oasis and monetize it and turn it into a place where it's just about transactional relationships, and it's about doing what's good for the company, which is selling advertising and manipulating people and that kind of thing, as opposed to the original creator wants it to be a place of fun and joy, and you just come and get to live out your fantasies and make friends and do all this stuff. So two kind of competing visions of what the internet is for. So, and then that, I think, maps onto the real life history of the internet, right? Is the internet going to be this kind of democratic institution where everybody is equal and we all get to live and you know, do what's good for ourselves? Or is it going to be primarily a business where some people make money off of other people for profit? And that's the tension that the film is exploring. And Halliday's idea of the Easter egg was to create a puzzle that only somebody like himself could solve, right? You had to be very similar in interest and personality to Halliday to win the contest, which is a way of sort of figuring out who his intellectual or spiritual descendant is, right? His heir is not going to be his biological children. So these are going to be his sort of children in spirit, so to say.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is John McAteer, and he has written a film review about the new Steven Spielberg-directed film, Ready Player One, based on the novel, and his review is called Spielberg's Nostalgia for Reality in Ready Player One, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. To read more cultural apologetics articles, like John's two upcoming feature articles on the worldview of actor Morgan Freeman and the HBO series Westworld, please subscribe to the Journal. And we currently have a lower rate of $33.50. And to subscribe online, visit equip.org. Well, you were talking about just who's going to, you know, he's kind of created this Easter egg in this contest to try to find somebody who is a kind of a spiritual successor to his own kind of worldview. And, but considering that everyone's living in this oasis, I want to just explore the question of identity that's raised in the film and in the book, actually. So what do you think of these avatars that they create, which of course is available now when anyone's playing some of these big multiplayer online games? Currently, they select their own avatar. And a lot of times you can change how you look, or you can, you know, have different color hair, or be a different age, or be a different gender, or you can do anything like that. In fact, there's a joke within the book and the film just talking about, like, how do you know who you're talking to is another kid? How do you know it's not some, you know, middle-aged man named Chuck living in his mom's basement? So how do you think Christians should think about this issue? And especially if they're playing video games, how should they approach creating their own avatars?
Another really interesting and complex question. I haven't thought a whole lot about the ethics of avatars per se. You know, you might think it's almost like a lie to present yourself in a way that's different than how you really are. On the other hand, this is part of the accepted sort of culture of online gaming that we all know that everybody is customizing their avatar. And so it's not, you shouldn't expect someone to be just like their avatar. So it's not really a lie per se. There's no intention necessarily to deceive someone. But again, I would suggest that maybe a more helpful way to think about the film is not about video games per se necessarily, but about the internet in general again, right? So think about the way we all present a particular image of ourselves on our online presence. Like, so when we're on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, we only choose to portray a certain picture of what we're like. We only take pictures of ourselves when we're happy and put them on to Instagram or whatever. We only put pictures of ourselves that we think where we look beautiful. We might choose the best filter to make ourselves look better than we normally would in real life. We choose the camera angles very carefully, right? We only talk about the good things that are happening in our lives on Facebook. We don't necessarily portray ourselves in the most kind of raw and authentic way because we want other people to think well of us, right? And so that's a normal human impulse, but it does separate us from people, right? These technologies are supposed to allow us to connect with other people, right? That's what social media is supposed to do. But we end up disguising ourselves, right? And then that's what the avatars are about in this film. They're talking about characters wanting to look different. Maybe one of them has a birthmark that she's ashamed of, so she takes that off in her avatar. You mentioned that there's the one woman who's a black woman who wants to be a white man in the film and in the Oasis because she knows that people will treat her differently. So she's trying to escape some of that prejudice that she faces. And same with the one character who's a child who wants to appear as an adult to escape some of those prejudices that he faces. And so they have kind of on the one hand, a good motivation, right, to correct some of the biases that we have when we engage with each other in real life. But I still think there's something something lost when you disguise yourself and enter into a what's supposed to be a friendship, an online friendship, but you're not revealing who you really are. You lose that ability to have a genuine human connection, because it seems to me that real connection requires vulnerability. And that means not having the ability to control how the other person sees you. And that's those are some of the questions I think that the film presents. It doesn't do a lot with them, but it shows us that. There's one scene in particular where they talk about this, the character, the main character, Wade Watts, or he goes by the name Percival as his avatar. Percival meets this woman, Artemis, is the woman in the game, and he knows her from her gameplay, and he's followed her. He's a big fan of her. And when he first meets her, he tells her he loves her. And she says, "You don't love me. You don't even know who I am. You don't know who I really am. You don't know anything about me other than what I portray to you. And that's what you love. You love this image that I've created, which may or may not be anything like me." And so the film is aware of these issues and tries to bring them up a little bit.
Well, I know that a lot of times, you know, people will read a book and the common comment is, well, it was nothing like the movie. But I know that we want to have books and movies, they're different. Even if it was based on a book, they stand alone as two different works of art. And but I do want to kind of mention something that they don't really directly address in the movie, although there is about a page or so that's addressed at the very beginning of the book. And when it opens up into these slums called the Stacks, where Wade Watts lives, he says, "Of course, this all happens, and we know that God is dead." And it goes on this diatribe about how, you know, religion is dead as God is dead, as we don't believe in God anymore. So definitely the character in both the film and also in the book, I would say that he does not depend on any kind of religion to make moral decisions or overcome these various different challenges within the game. So what do you think that the film has to say about humanity's relationship to religion in this dystopian future? But has society made Oasis a religion? I mean, that is something that really struck me in the book more than the film, but I would say the same thing. It's like, in order to win this game, you have to know everything that there is to know about the creator, one of the creators, James Halliday. And in order to do that, you have to meticulously study everything that he said, everything that he did, videos of his life, know about every single solitary, you know, book that he read, movie that he watched, TV show that he liked. And you just almost have to, you know, immerse yourself in his whole worldview and his life. So has kind of James Halliday become a god, like a little g god, like almost an idol to the people that live in the Oasis virtually?
I think that's exactly right. And I think the film is perhaps aware of that in a way that I'm not sure that the book was quite as clear. I mean, the book does portray, as you say, the main character as an atheist. I think the novelist is famous as an atheist. He's critiqued religion before in other writings. He's trying to portray a world without religion, but I think he accidentally does create a new religion. I'm not sure how intentional this was, but everything you said was exactly right, that Halliday has become kind of like the god of this world that he's created. He's created his own world that he's the god of, and all of the other, he's made all the other characters study him the way that Christians study the Bible, for example, and that we want to know how to live our lives. And so we go and read the Bible. We study what Jesus did. We kind of have this whole seminary structure and education structure, and everybody spends their lives, you know, studying these sacred texts. Well, in the world of Ready Player One, the sacred text is Halliday's journals and things like that. And so they can go and read and watch and play the video games he owned. And his whole life has been set up like a museum or a library that's very much like a temple or a church or something like that. And the characters do have this sort of religious relationship from him. It's giving their life a kind of meaning and a worldview, although there's not much substance to it, right? I mean, it's essentially a religion made out of 80s pop culture. And I'm not sure what kind of depth there is to that. That's where I think maybe that the novelist hasn't necessarily thought about this as a religion. You'd think he would try to make it a little more meaty if he was trying to create a religion, but he did create something that fulfills a lot of the function of religion in people's lives. So maybe this goes to the old idea that everybody has to worship something, and even if you think you don't worship God, you do worship something else in your life, and God has created us to be essentially worshipers. That's just what a human being is. So I think maybe that's perhaps an unintentional aspect of the film.
Well, definitely the book is, I would say, a love story to the 1980s. There are just so many references, some of them even extremely obscure in the book. Does someone need to know a lot about the 80s to appreciate this film? I do know there's a lot of references to video games, like visual references. In fact, a teenager I know was saying there was over 130 references to various different, those are kind of like Easter eggs for all the gamers that can watch this film. But do people have to know a lot about the 80s and video games to enjoy this film?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly not to understand the basic plot. This is maybe something that a way in which the film is superior to the novel. The novel is much more detailed in the discussions of the pop culture, and you go through reenacting things. In the film, it's Spielberg is a visual thinker. That's what makes him such a great filmmaker. And so he's able to do a lot of this stuff visually. And so you just have in the background, you'll have lots of references, Easter eggs, as you want to call them, to video games and movies and whatever. But it's if you don't recognize the reference, it just goes by and it doesn't affect you one way or the other. So I don't know that you have to know the references to get to understand the film. Although it is also a film, I think one of the main themes is about nostalgia. And so you kind of need to be aware that there are references to things, even if you don't get them, because it's drawing on that subject matter of people who are obsessed with the past kind of thing.
I think it was interesting that in one scene, they do it a little bit more in depth in the book. Like, they have to act out certain scenes from famous films, but just Steven Spielberg just approached that differently. They get to this place where they have to figure out a classic film. And one of the main characters says, "What do I do? I never even watched that film." So I think he's saying, well, it's okay if you don't know everything about this X film that came out in the 80s kind of a thing. I do want to talk about Steven Spielberg because he is the director of this film. And lately, over the last decade or so, he's been making more, serious historical films. Last year, he directed the Oscar-nominated film The Post about the Washington Post, and he's also done The Bridges of Spies that dealt with World War II. And so is this film kind of a return to his earlier work, the sci-fi action that we knew about him at the very beginning? If you think about Steven Spielberg, people knew him because of E.T. and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Although I would say as his career went on, the sci-fi movies he made were much more thinky, like AI, which is a really disturbing movie. If anyone's never seen that, that'll stay with you for a while after you see it. And then also Minority Report that was done back in the early 2000s, which is kind of interesting because some of the things then, I don't know if that was like prophetic or people had thought about this will happen in the future, but I remember in that film, Tom Cruise plays this character and he's walking by all these billboards and they change depending on who's walking in front of them and ads that they would be interested in. But now we all go online and as we're there, we're looking at ads of things that we've already searched or things that they think we'd be interested based on our race or age or gender or something like that. So it's kind of like, wow, he was saying that in his film back in 2002 and now it's come true.
Yeah, I mean, I encourage your readers to watch Minority Report. It's really an excellent film that deals with a lot of interesting philosophical and theological ideas. And as you say, a lot of the technology in that film has become real since he made it. And I was kind of hoping that this film, the Ready Player One, would be more like Minority Report. I think it's not. It seems to be more like, recently Spielberg has been making a lot of those more grown-up movies. But he's also made a couple of kids movies. He made The BFG a couple years ago about the Roald Dahl book, and he made Tintin, which was a fully animated film, computer animated. BFG was about half real and half animated. They went into this world of giants in that movie. I think those are the touchstones for this film. It doesn't end up being, you know, as deep and interesting as a lot of Spielberg's more grown-up movies. And it doesn't end up being as much kind of fun as his classic movies. So I think it's in some ways a little bit disappointing as a film. But one thing that Spielberg is still great at is the action sci-fi special effects scene. So the chases and the, you know, battles and things that are in this movie are excellent. He really does computer graphics, I think, better than most other people. I compare this to a lot of the kind of comic book movies you get. And, you know, every comic book movie has a big battle at the end of the movie where, to me, it just looks like watching someone else play a video game. You just have computer animation battling other computer animation, and it's kind of pretty boring. But Spielberg did that same thing, and his movie literally is, you know, watching a video game. You're watching people battle each other within this virtual world, but he does it so much better than I've ever seen anyone else do it.
You know, I totally agree with you. When I was watching it, I was thinking, a lot of times when I watch movies, and maybe even in some favorite movies like, you know, the Lord of the Rings series or the Hobbit series, I just think, here comes the big CGI scene. And you just think, okay, I'm just going to endure all the CGI. And maybe it's because the subject matter was a video game that you're inside. But I kept thinking about just the marvels of what it took for computer programming to even do some of those scenes, especially the very first scene where there's a racing scene. I just thought, man, this is going to get some kudos in terms of programming, because just the math and physics that you need to know to make those things seem really real, that he was really in this particular race with all these different cars and King Kong and so forth. So it was very, very well done. I agree with you about that. Now, we've been mentioning that this film is based on a book by Ernest Cline, and the book itself was a bit controversial for some. So do you know why that is?
Well, the controversy, I think, has to do with its portrayal of gamers or nerds in general. The book has a very old-fashioned idea of what gamers are, and it has this kind of classic image of nerds as these kind of overweight, socially awkward young white men, and their way of being a nerd is to memorize trivia about, you know, old science fiction. You know, you can name, you know, all of the characters in Star Wars or whatever, and nowadays, that because of there's something called Gamergate, which I won't get into, but your readers can Google that. Because of this, there's a kind of a shift in the way people have attitudes towards gamers. We've begun to see that the old-fashioned image is a little bit more exclusive and tends to keep people out who don't fit that stereotypical model. Gamers in real life are increasingly diverse. There's lots of different kinds of people who are not kind of that classic nerd who would fit into this category of people who love comic books and video games and tabletop games and science fiction and all that stuff. So people are worried that this the story of Ready Player One kind of supports this old-fashioned view and is exclusive of modern people. And also the story implies that memorizing trivia about, you know, old science fiction movies somehow makes you a better person, or you're more worthy to run the Oasis, right? Because that's what you have to do to win the contest and to take over this world, is to just memorize stuff. And so people think that seems pretty shallow as a way of judging the quality of somebody's character, that they just because they can memorize stuff, right? And you think, wouldn't we want someone who doesn't just watch movies all day, but, you know, actually is knows how to make the real world a better place, to give them control of such a powerful thing, you know. And there's also worry about the idea of nostalgia as being too backward looking. You're never creating anything new. You're just sort of recycling old cliches. The world outside is depressing, and we're just going to escape from that by going into our private, you know, fantasy world that never really connects to anybody else. And so people, I think, are worried about the politics, basically the politics of this world that's been imaginatively created. And I get the critique why people might think this was problematic. I personally, I mean, I agree. The book is not politically sophisticated. It's pretty shallow. But I didn't think about that when I was reading the book or watching the film. I don't know that we have to take it so politically. You know, not everything has to be politically correct to me. It's just a fun kind of adventure fantasy, and I enjoyed it on that level.
So what they're doing in this oasis, internet oasis, is basically a lot of virtual reality that they're living. Do you think that the film realistically portrays virtual reality?
You know, I'm not sure. This is another criticism I've heard by people who are experts in virtual reality have seen the film as being a little bit, you know, not necessarily realistic, or maybe an older vision of what virtual reality would be, or there were contradictions, et cetera. You know, I don't know enough about it to know, but again, to me, I don't think that Spielberg is that interested in virtual reality. I think for him, he's using it as a metaphor for the internet in general, or social media in particular, just our ways of connecting with other people. To me, that's what Spielberg is interested in.
So in your review, you suggest that the movie's kind of like Spielberg's ethics of technology, what he thinks about technology. So what do you think his view of technology is in this film?
Yeah, so, I mean, technology is just our fancy word for tools, right? Anything that helps us do something we couldn't otherwise do. So technology helps human beings accomplish their purposes. And one form of technology is media. And what we mean by media is just something that helps us communicate ideas or information from one person to another. And so media is supposed to be a tool that accomplishes the goal of connecting people, creates connections. So if you're thinking about an ethics of media or an ethics of technology, then you'd have to think, well, something is a good piece of technology, a good piece of ethics, a good piece of media, if it allows you to actually connect to other people. But if something promises to connect you to other people, but in fact disconnects you from other people, you could say that it's failing to do what it's supposed to do, which is an ethical failing, I would say. It's making you less human in certain ways. And so what the film is thinking about is, I would say, in some ways it's reflecting on the nature of nostalgia in particular. So Spielberg himself was a great proponent of nostalgia. If you watch his early, you know, 80s films, E.T., Close Encounters, Indiana Jones, a lot of these movies are movies that are about nostalgia for the past. They're drawing on Spielberg's own memories of childhood, the things that he loved as a child, and he brings them into these movies to try to entertain new generations. And so you might think, well, that's Spielberg is both the perfect person to tell a movie about nostalgia, but he's also maybe a problematic one because he himself falls into some of these areas of looking backward as opposed to forward. But I would argue that Spielberg, in fact, his form of nostalgia was different. The old-fashioned nostalgia is different than this new kind of gamer nostalgia from Ready Player One. And you can see this in some of the ways that Spielberg makes changes from the book. I think he might be critiquing the book, critiquing modern kind of nerd culture and nostalgia by arguing that nostalgia is only good insofar as it connects us to other people. So if you think about nerd culture back in the 80s or whenever, the whole point of having these groups of people, like having a Comic-Con, having a Star Trek convention, creating websites where you have all of your nerd interests on there. The point is to connect with other people because nerds traditionally, and I count myself as a nerd, right? Where we are a little bit socially awkward. We have these passions that other people don't share. We love these things a lot. And other people kind of look at us sideways and think, well, there's something weird about that person. He spends way too much time, reading Star Wars books or whatever. And so what nerd culture does is allow you to connect to other people with similar interests. And so Spielberg is from that generation where he's saying, like, all these old movies I loved when I was a kid, I want to find other people who love those same things so that we can connect. But in the Ready Player One, a lot of the function of that nostalgia is not to connect you to other people who are similar, but it's to separate you from them, to say, well, I'm better than you because I know this stuff that other people don't know. That it becomes a kind of a gatekeeper thing. You can't be in our club unless you know these things. So it almost has the opposite function of the kind of old-fashioned nerd culture, which was not to separate you from other people, but to connect you to them. And I think that's what Spielberg is trying to do with his film, is kind of show that the true purpose of these things is to allow you to create a kind of community of people with similar passions and values and that kind of thing. So that is a positive use of nostalgia, loving these old things and that kind of thing.
I think that is an important thing for him to bring out. I mean, it's so true. It might be a stereotype, but it is true. I mean, if you're some people might have to Google some of this, but if you're like on any subreddit or if you're making a comment on YouTube within the nerd culture, because there's certain, I consider myself a nerd also, and there's certain things that I enjoy as hobbies that, attract a lot of nerds. And if you critique something that they love or hold almost in a reverent, almost a religious sense, I mean, boy, those nerd trolls will descend on you and just have at it. So it's less community building as much as, well, you don't really know every single solitary thing there is to know about this X thing in nerd culture. So therefore, you're not qualified to even make a comment. And so sometimes that's what it's kind of descended to instead of having it be more of a community, which I think is an interesting differentiation. Well, how can the Christian apologist use this film as an apologetics tool?
So I think definitely the film and the novel raise lots of interesting questions that we've been talking about. And so these are the kind of conversations that I think people could have. Certainly, the question you asked about the religious nature of the Oasis is great and leads to questions about how we as human beings tend to turn everything into a religion. And whether these sort of non-Christian religions can actually satisfy our deepest longings that we clearly have to try to worship something. So there's those kind of questions. There's questions that we've been talking about the nature of community, what sorts of communities are valuable, what sorts of values sustain communities. And you might think that, I do think that Christianity has values that create a better sorts of community than the alternative. So you could think of the church, the local church, as a kind of place to go and find people. And maybe there's a sort of nostalgia about the way we think back and read the Bible, but it's not meant to be sort of narcissistic and insular the way that the film portrays some of these gamers, but it's meant to be a way of of connecting us to each other and teaching us, inspiring us to go and make the real world better and to live out the mission of God in our society. So that's, I mean, lots of stuff. All the stuff that we've talked about so far, I think, would be relevant to apologists.
And also I want to say to parents, even though this is rated PG-13, it's got violence, but not like it's got computer generated type of violence. It doesn't really have anything objectionable in it. And so therefore, I think it would be a great tool for a youth group even to talk with kids about and then have their kids, you know, Christian kids invite other kids, just because so many kids, Christian and non-Christian, are gamers and they can relate to the premise because so many of them, you know, would really kind of want to talk about some of these issues, or maybe they haven't talked about how much technology and the internet affects them, and it's a way to get them talking about those issues. Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for John. So John, what's your favorite condiment?
Mayonnaise, I guess.
And is there a movie that you can watch over and over and not get tired of?
There's a ton of movies. I don't know why. The first one I thought of was Star Wars.
That's probably true for me. I've seen Star Wars so many times. I just love that film. And would you rather see a movie in the theater or would you rather see it at home?
Definitely in the theater. It's a whole different experience.
I agree. I don't know. Speaking of Spielberg, he was talking about how he doesn't think that people who do these short releases of films, but they're on Netflix, should be able to be eligible for Oscars, because he said this wasn't made to be seen on a TV or your iPad or an iPhone. This was made to be seen in a theater. So I thought that was an interesting commentary he had on that. Well, thanks, John, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you.
John has written a film review about the new Steven Spielberg directed film Ready Player One, and his review is called Spielberg's Nostalgia for Reality in Ready Player One, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. To read more cultural apologetics articles like John's upcoming feature on the worldview of actor Morgan Freeman, please subscribe to the journal, and we have a new special lower rate of $33.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes and rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others discover our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Hank is also regularly streaming live on Facebook and YouTube, so please check equip.org for dates and times. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thank you for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.